This is NYPC Radio, the New York Podcasting Cafe, with host Conan Amoros.
Hi, this is Carmen Amoros, host of the New York Podcasting Cafe, a program featuring interviews with public figures, celebrities, writers, authors, artists, playwrights, counselors, lecturers, as well as independent artists and musicians, all here on the New York Podcasting Cafe. Roxanne Fontana was born in Brooklyn, New York, and spent her childhood in the 1960s living a few blocks from the childhood home of Arthur Miller in the predominantly Italian and Jewish neighborhood of the part of Brooklyn bordering Midwood and Bensonhurst. In 1968, Fontana developed an interest in fashion design after a child modeling tryout. She developed her songwriting, guitar playing, singing, and journal writing while living in Elmont, Long Island in the United States in the 1970s. An avid music fanatic, Fontana ran an international fan club for Rolling Stone Brian Jones, which was officially recognized by the Stones in the mid to late 1970s. Fontana has over 80 compositions registered in the United States. She started her career at New York nightclubs during the 1980s with multiple performances at CBGB's, The Bitter End, and Webster Hall, among others. She dominated several rock bands with all of her writing materials and fronting for The Blue Way, Kid Blue, and Ruzenka and the Big Dream Band. She released a popular Fontana song titled Life Trap in 1999. She appeared on the cover of the East Village's local newspaper, Downtown, where she was labeled the hippest lady in New York. She has formed and worked with various rock groups, one of them psychedelic group Ruzenka and the Big Dream with Rich Teeter from New York punk rock group The Dictators. In 1993, Andy Warhol assistant, poet, and photographer Gerard Malanga wrote of Fontana, predicting Fontana as the voice reaching the millennium, and her music was referred to by rock writer and musician Lenny Kaye as shimmering nighttime pop. She worked with legendary drummer Dino Danelli of the hit 1960s rock group The Rascals after seeking him out to play drums for one of her songs on a record, with musical contributions by Marty Wilson Piper, the Australian rock The Church, and Benji King, formerly of the new wave group Scandal. But the record was rejected by Atlantic Records, and the record was self-released by Fontana herself against Danelli's wishes. AllMusic titled the record Mysterious and Inviting. The next year, Fontana followed up with a folk rock CD, which was more in line with her preferred style of music, the orchestrated folk rock of the mid-1960s. Gordon Raphael, producer of The Strokes, recorded the album for her at his Transportrum Studios in New York City, East Village, and played on every track on the record. Critic Joe Viglione said of the album, "Fontana does a fine job producing herself, and the record is a departure from the sound forged on the debut disc." Fontana moved to L.A. several times, spent time in Holland and Germany, returned to New York on several occasions to record and sing at local nightclubs. In 2001, she married Montreal guitarist-singer Matt Traber. She serves as his manager and his songwriter. In 2006, the couple moved to England to be near Traber's chosen musicians and band. Fontana has released some recordings from her unreleased catalog, starting with a song entitled Green, in the mid-1990s. She also released a number of tracks recorded in Holland, entitled The Best of the 80s. She continues to record sporadically Another Place, a song by Francois Hardy, The Fields of Saint Etienne, a song by Gallagher and Lyle. In 2013, in Brighton, England, Fontana recorded originals New Moon Child and Passing By, produced by Russell C. Brennan. Fontana's record sales and the interest in her music have grown year after year into an international cult status in the truest indie artist manner. Fontana has played occasional acoustic shows in New York City, Prague, and London in the 2010s. In August of 2015, Fontana went into the studio in New York with producer Jack Douglas to record the song Time Won't Wait. speaking with DJ Steve Dima on Little Water Radio in New York the following week, Fontana stated that she had written the song the night of December 8th of 1980, shortly before the death of John Lennon. It had always been her goal to record the song with Douglas, Lennon's producer, who had been working with Lennon on his final recordings, including the night he was assassinated. The song was released worldwide on December 8th, 2015, the 35th anniversary of both the song's conception and John Lennon's murder. Please join me in welcoming to the New York Podcasting Cafe singer, songwriter, musician, fashion designer, artist, Roxanne Fontana. Hello, Roxanne Fontana. Thank you for being on NYPC Radio, the New York Podcasting Cafe. Such an honor to have you.
Oh, thank you so much, Carmen. Hello to you. Hello, New York.
I see that you're a Brooklyn girl. You're originally from Arthur Miller's old stomping grounds. Is that true, what I hear?
Yes, I think I'm actually from around two blocks away from where he used to live and write and everything. Yeah, magical neighborhood, just a couple blocks away. Yes.
He came to live somewhere on Montague Street some years later when he was married to Marilyn Monroe. I think their address was 72 Montague Street, but I had no idea that he lived in that area.
Yes, I think he lived, I think it's East 4th Street or East 5th Street or East 3rd Street off Avenue N areas, right around there. And I think that was in his prolific period where he wrote his big stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You never ran into him or anything like that, of course.
Yes. But, well, I might have, exactly, but I wouldn't know if I did.
It's just so refreshing to talk to someone from Brooklyn who lives in the UK. I was expecting to hear someone who sounds like Adele with a beautiful British accent, but instead I got a beautiful Brooklyn accent. I love that.
Yes.
I love that.
It's definitely unusual to find people live, and I don't live in London either. I live in the countryside, so that's even more odd because I'm from New York living in the British countryside, but I just love it here. I really do. I mean, it has its drawbacks, but for the most part, it's really beautiful and healthy, and I visited New York this past summer, and I had such an immense time. It was wonderful. But I was constantly laughing at the assault on all five senses and more by just like the smell and, you know, not having much vision in front of me, and, you know, compared to the way I live now. It was so offensive. It was funny to me. But I had such a great time, but it's completely different than the life I live now.
I was doing research on you. You have quite an enormous history.
I have a very rich creative history, but I don't have any so much in so much as a commercial history. And the Rolling Stones, I had a fan club for their founding member, Brian Jones, which they sort mm-hmm. of took me to be the representative of Brian Jones when I was a teenager. So that was the story with that, yes. I had an interest in fashion since I was a child, actually, in Brooklyn. It was my dream to be a fashion designer when I was a kid in Brooklyn. But no, the music was all done early on. I'm still doing it, obviously, but the fashion mm-hmm. came about when I was living in Los Angeles and I was pregnant with my daughter and I was also managing my husband's music. And so I wasn't doing anything with music at that time. I had sort of retired from it and had written a book about most of the time period and, you know, chose to just be married, manage my husband's music, and have a child. But still, you know, you would think that's enough to do, but with me, it's never enough to do. So I got into doing jewelry mm-hmm. design. And there are so many people who do jewelry design, but I got very lucky with it, and I went around to the shops in Beverly Hills and around Los Angeles mm-hmm. area, and they loved my stuff, and they took them in, and they took them into chain stores, you know, where a lot of the things are factory made, and they were selling my handmade chokers made of antique and vintage beads, mainly from Africa's and Europe, 1800s, beads from the 1800s, and they were really successful, especially the men's chokers, and they were used in Hollywood films. I don't really know about which ones. I would just bring them, and then you would say, you know, you would hear that it was used in a film and then brought back to the shop and things like that. So, yes, yeah, so it was really successful. And then when I moved to England, I decided to take a fashion course at Coventry University with my husband. We both went in it together, and I really didn't. It was just sort mm-hmm. of something to do. And then all of a sudden, you know, once I knew how to do things, then it became very interesting because I'd go to Paris for a holiday and end up in the, you know, the district where they sold all the fabrics, and say, yo, you know, this would be great, and so would this, and buy 7 fabrics and make a limited edition of midriff blouses.
Your stuff got around to some of the top places over in California and all
the jewelry
of these marvelous stores.
Here in England, I opened a shop that had all of my creation. I guess it's major vanity ego shop, but it had all the clothes I'm making, the hats. I do velvet berets and velvet hot pants. And the jewelry and my records were on the shelf, and I had that open for a limited period of time just to sort of do it, you know. And that was fun because I did it in a market town. The little shop that I had was housed in a building that was from the 1500s. So it was it was a blast to do that. That was really great. But, you know, I still have stock and everything, and I'm still designing, but I sort of did it, you know, because I could, and I did, and that was a very... an interesting thing to do. Well, the materials I use, whether it's the clothes or whether it's the jewelry, I always use really good materials because otherwise I'm not interested. So the fabrics I use are Italian mesh fabrics or French fabrics, silks, and the jewelry pieces that I've done, the chokers, the beads, some of them are a few hundred years old, you know, so it's the quality is good. You can tell the difference that it's not a beaded choker from, you know, a beach in Venice, California. Like, this is the real thing, you know. It's great. I'm really into just beauty of music, beauty of art, beauty of clothes, jewelry.
You were quoted by the local downtown newspaper as being the hipst lady in New York. You left Los Angeles again before returning to New York in the mid-1990s?
Well, the book that I wrote called American Girl, which is a memoir that goes up to 1999, has the story, and I pretty much label myself as a bi-coastal artist. And so I've always been Los Angeles, New York, Los Angeles, New York, even though I'm from New York, and New York is my home. L.A. is my second home, and... the magazine, the downtown magazine, Hippest Lady in New York. Yeah, I was in between. I was living there for a while, and that was a pretty scary, pretty scary tag. I think it was within a year I was back in Los Angeles after that. That was a East Village newspaper, and that's really cool. At the time, I thought it was pretty scary, though. Like, you know, the Hippest Lady in New York. You know, that's a scary thing to have to live up to, or also it could invite criticism. But everybody was really nice, so that's good. That was something that happened in I was living in Amsterdam, actually, for a few summers and doing demos over there with a bunch of musicians that I discovered that were on the German-Dutch border. And what happened was I recorded these great records and came back to America to do something with them. And nothing was really happening, so I went back there again, and then I came back, and, you know, I just had to stay in New York because I wasn't legally allowed to stay in Europe at that time. I've since found a way to do it legally, but I wasn't allowed to do it at that time, and so I had to stay in New York at that point, and so I started playing acoustic shows, and I think that's when that newspaper article came out about the Hippest Lady in New York, and I did something like six shows in a month and a half all around the New York area, acoustic shows. And that was under my name, Roseanne Fontana, at the time. And, that was fun. And then after that newspaper article happened, I think within a year, I was living back in Los Angeles again. So I guess I've got ants in my pants, you know. I just keep moving around. And I'm still doing it now with a husband and a child of special needs. So nothing can stop me, I guess, you know. I just keep moving around every few years.
You're unstoppable between your fashion and your singing. When did you begin to sing and write? Do you have a marker in your timeline when you can recall that you began
write? Well, I didn't start songwriting until probably around 1972. I was a kid, 12 years old. I had just learned how to play the guitar, and I almost immediately started writing songs because I didn't really have the discipline to learn how to read music. I was taught it, but I didn't have any interest in it, but I knew that I had an interest in pop songs. And so that sort of, what am I going to do? So I just started writing my own songs, and it came really natural to me. And then when I was in my 20s, I wrote so many songs. I mean, it's, you know, and the songs, because I've been influenced by, I guess you would call it classic rock, but it's more like 60s music, Smokey Robinson. It's not just, you know, white rock bands, you know.
I know
it's it's a lot of soul music that I loved. And the pop stuff, you know, top 40 radio of the 1960s is a big influence on me. And, you know, it's strange, though, because the combination of influences make for what I think are really strong songs. And then I put them out, and people really react to them, you know. And that's without any corporation telling them, this is it, this is what you're going to like this week. And so that's really even more fulfilling, to be a completely independent artist. And some people call themselves indie artists because they're not affiliated with a top conglomerate, but they're not really indie because they have businesses behind them. I'm truly an indie artist. I'm doing it all myself. And the reward of that, the upside of it, is that when people react to it, it's genuine. And it's not because they've heard it a lot and they're being told this is what you're going to like right now. It's because they're really, in fact, when you don't have that kind of backing, people are even more wary to accept it. They're actually listening to it with more of a critical ear. I mean, it's just human nature, And so when you get people to react to something strongly and they say to me, I love this song, I know that I've got something going on, because they're really reacting to it without anyone telling them, and they're actually coming at me with a critical ear instead of an open ear, And that's a hard thing to do, but the reward is so satisfying. And of course, the downside is the financial side of it, But
that's true.
Whatever, that's the way it
goes.
No
limousines, no 5-star hotels. A lot of people in other countries may think that New Yorkers are some of the most spoiled people in the world, but we're not. We're very adaptable. We adapt to our environment very easily, especially folks from Brooklyn.
Yes, yes.
We pause for a moment to introduce Roxanne Fontana in her song titled "Passing By."
Get by. Hey.
This is NYPC Radio, the New York Podcasting Cafe, with host Carmen Amoros.
New York is a very difficult place. It's not easy. And that was why I've always run to Los Angeles, because, you know, when I couldn't take New York anymore, and, you know, being single, because I was single, I didn't get married until I was 40 years old. So being single all those years, the sort of typical single woman in New York City, you know, it gets really harsh. And then you have to run to Los Angeles, where the sun is shining and the apartments are four times the size, and people are looking to employ you. So it's easy to get a day job in Los Angeles because they love New York workers. That's a sort of stereotype that I found to be completely true when
hard
I was
workers.
Young. And so I was, I was able to get jobs in art galleries and places like that. And, you know, so it was very easy. But then when I got sick of the sort of simplicity of Los Angeles and the suburbia of it all, I'd find myself preparing to go back to New York and living in one room and all of that, you know. So
You have to be.
Yeah, the club circuit was always enjoyable in New York City and in Los Angeles. But, you know, to give a better example of that, at one point I was living in Los Angeles and I was working for Connie Stevens, and she loved me because she's Italian from New York, you know.
Really?
And so she
Connie
just loved
Stevens?
Me, and I left because, yes, Connie Stevens. And, and I had to leave because I was in one of my phases where, you know, I've had enough of this place. I have to get back to New York City, to reality, to, you know, to problems, you know. So I went back to New York, and she called me. I was living in a two-bedroom apartment in New York City with six artists, and they were all Czechoslovakian artists. And she called me there, and she said, "No, you come back. You can live. Come and live in my house." And I said, "What, with your daughters?" And she said, "No, with me." And, you know, I didn't know what to say. She was offering me to live in her house in Bel Air. And I said to her, I said, "Connie, I'm living in an apartment with six Czechoslovakian artists." she didn't say anything more. She identified, I guess, as to why I was back in New York. And she, everything was, you know, I actually did end up going back there years later, like 10 years later or something, and working for her again. But but that's a good example of the New York adaptation extends to our honesty with ourselves. And, you know what you can handle, and you know what you know, if it's worth it.
Now, in living with Connie Stevens, you did some work with Dino Danelli, who was the legendary drummer for the Rascals that sang "It's a Beautiful Morning."
Yes, it is, and that's the first single I ever bought. It was "It's a Beautiful Morning." And,
me too.
Yeah, how that came about was I was living in New York City, and I wanted to, there's one song that I had called "Spring in Love," and I had done two or three recordings of it, and I just didn't like the way the recording sounded. I thought, there's something missing about this. It's just, it's either too sweet or it's too harsh. I'm not getting what I want to get. I said, what I need is a sort of blue-eyed soul like the Rascals used to do. And and I figured, that is what I need. This song needs to be like Rascals for it to fulfill what I'm hearing in my head when I wrote it. And so I found Dino. I got in touch with him. And I said, you know, I would love for you to sort of play drums. Do you still play drums? I would love for you to play drums on this one song that I have. I want to go into the studio and record it properly. And I told him the story. So he said, okay, I'm working at a studio. Come down. Bring me the demos that you have of it. And so I did that, and I brought him the demos. And within a week, he was up in my apartment telling me that he wanted to not play drums but produce a full album for me. And so I was really flattered with that. That was a big, because I'm a huge Rascals fan as a New Yorker and as an Italian, and just, you know, as a music fan, because they had so many big hits, you know?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, the Love is Blue CD was done with Dino. I had already been a veteran of the clubs, you know, CBGB's, the Bitter End, and all that for a really long time. So I was there, but Dino wasn't doing that at all. He was doing studio stuff with people he would find, and he was doing, he wasn't even doing anything like the kind of music that the Rascals did or anything. He was doing electronic music, which I had no idea that he was doing that, because it was sort of, I think, more underground for himself. And he sort of pulled my spring in love and dragged me into this world of electronica. And he was doing that song. And even after we parted ways and I finished the album, he was still demoing my song Spring in Love with other female artists.
Right.
Which, you know, yeah, he was obsessed with that song, and he did it so many times, and young girls would write to me, and they would be, like, really young, you know, more than half my age, and say, I'm doing your song. I love your song, Spring and Love. I'm doing it with Dino. I just thought, yeah, and I thought, okay, whatever, fine. I've got my version. Good luck, you know? So that was that whole scene, yeah.
Sometime later, you released a folk rock CD, so you made a switch from the electronic, you know, to folk rock.
Yes,
and
yes, I went back to the sound that I, yeah, that went great. I love my Souvenir d'Amour record. I did that with the producer of The Strokes. He didn't produce it. I produced it, but he recorded it in his studio, and he played on every song on it, so he did have a big input on, you know, I think it's a great record. It's totally different than the Love is Blue album. There was one reviewer, I think it was Goldmine Magazine, that reviewed the two records together as a tale of two different kinds of pop sounds, and that was enjoyable. Yeah.
So Tortelli of Goldmine Magazine revealed that Santana, meaning you, possess an innocent yet world-weary voice. Contrasting the two release styles, he said, titled These CDs a la Tale of Two Pop Sounds, one electronic and percussive, the other haunting folk rock. Can you liken that style to any one artist that we know at the moment, in this period?
The Souvenir d'Amour record probably sounds closer to 1960s, French pop music or Marianne Faithfull and those artists. 1966, every girl made a record that sounds like my Souvenir d'Amour album, I think. Only the difference was with those records, they used real orchestras, and I didn't use a real orchestra. I used Gordon Raphael, the producer, because he's such an exquisite keyboard player. He could get every sound. Of course, it's not the same, but it came out fantastic. So I can't really liken it to anything that's been done in the past 40 years. It's more like a 1966 kind of record. Yeah.
You've been a prolific songwriter. You married a wonderful Montreal guitarist singer, Matt Treibers, and you co-wrote some songs with him, and you performed that, you know, a lot of your material in a Los Angeles nightclub.
Je ne peux pas voler. Yeah, je ne peux pas voler, which means I can't fly is the interpretation. We wrote that together in Los Angeles right after 9/11, and it's got really the lyrics really are about that whole era, about what was going on with the World Trade Center attack and then the consequent war and everything. It's been an exciting time, which was completely unexpected, you know. Not completely.
Yeah.
I was sort of told this was going to happen to me. Like when I was 23 or something, they told me that I was going to be popular when I was over 50 years old. And
it still looks fantastic, and you sound marvelous. I heard Time Won't Wait, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. It's right up my alley. I just love the lyrics.
Thank
you
so much.
Just beautiful music. It's sort of reminiscent of, like you said before, some things from somewhere, you know, between the late 60s, 70s, maybe mid-70s. Just beautiful. What inspired Time Won't Wait?
Well, nothing really. I was just home and wrote a song, and it happened to be December 8th, 1980, and it was early in the evening. I was living at my parents' house because I would live at my parents' house and work day jobs in New York City, save loads of money, and then go off on my next adventure, which would include music, recording, meeting musicians, playing clubs. And this is the way I was sort of living my life when I was in my 20s and even up to the mid-30s. And so that night, I just wrote that song early in the night and wrote the whole song on the 12-string guitar. And then I went to sleep, and I was woken up with the news that John Lennon had died. And it was a nightmare for me because I was a major Beatles fanatic. It was, you know, I was a Beatles fanatic since I was about 5 years old in Brooklyn. And so this really, you know, it hit me hard. And then I discovered that I wrote the song that night. So it was a magical song, like, oh, my God, you know, I wrote this that night. How crazy is that? And then to keep with the craziness of it was I ended up recording it 35 years later with John's producer. And that's, you know, and I love the way it came out. So, yeah, it's
I hear a little nuances. There's a little flavor of John Lennon in there. Some of the chords that are played, some of the notes that you hit vocally that are just so beautiful. You know, people love the familiar.
Thank you so much. It's okay. The strange thing is, I've been sitting on this song for 35 years, and I never thought it sounded Beatle-y until we recorded it and I brought it home. I didn't even think so in the studio. And when I brought it home and I put it into the CD machine to listen to it, I said, "Oh my God, this is so Beatles. This is so mid-period Beatles." Because I always just thought it sounded like a pop song, like a girl group pop song. But it wasn't until we recorded it, and then I said, "Wow, now this is that's even stranger because it actually sounds very Beatles, and I never thought that.
Sometimes we write things we don't even realize that they are, that they have a certain flavor, that they have a certain style, that they pick up something from some of the people that we love and admire. And I think every artist does that in their music somehow, without consciously, without being aware of it, you know? And John Lennon was just so dear to my heart. I met him one summer, one afternoon, just after walking out of the Museum of Art in Manhattan. And we were walking down the street, and I didn't know we were passing the Dakota. And we saw this slender guy walk out of the building, and he sort of got it in my way, wouldn't let us pass. And we did like a little dance, and I started becoming horrified because, honestly, I didn't recognize him. And when he saw that, I got a little bit nervous. He took his hat off. He did a very nice bow, and he let me walk by. And a couple of minutes later, the gentleman that I was with said, "Did you know who that was?" And I said, "No, I thought he was nuts." Oh my goodness, it was John Lennon. I didn't even know it was John Lennon. But it's just so
that's fantastic.
It was amazing. When your publicist told me your story, I said, "Oh no, I've got to do this. I've got to interview him."
Oh, that's so sweet.
You know,
that's a beautiful story. You're so lucky because I never saw him or the Beatles play live. I never met him or anything, and that's such a beautiful.
Yeah.
You're lucky.
It takes my breath away just thinking about it because here I am talking to you. You wrote this beautiful song with this beautiful haunting music. It's just such a beautifully written piece, and then to make that connection to having met John Lennon and then now meeting you, an artist who wrote the song on the eve of his passing, it's just mind-blowing. It really is mind-blowing.
Yes.
It really is
mind-blowing. Yes, I know. I know what you mean.
People have got to hear the song. I know that you have a sample of it, a little teaser on YouTube. Is that right? If people want to go listen to your music, where can they go on YouTube?
Okay, well, the full video to Time Won't Wait is now on YouTube, and it was shot in Liverpool, except the intro, which is Matt Treiber playing the piano intro, and that was done in my house. But the rest of the video was shot in Liverpool. It was shot on location in front of the house that John was raised in with his aunt, and it was also shot in front of the house that his mother lived where he was born. And then he went back to live there again for a short period of time when he was like five or six, I think, before going. Mm-hmm. So he was mainly at the other location, which was at his aunt's house in front of the bigger house in the video, and also alongside the wall of the Strawberry Fields Children Home, which is just walking distance from where he lived at his aunt's house. It's like literally a block and a half away. And so we shot it all there, and there's a scene of me passing the cavern also in Liverpool. And, it was, you know, I've been living in England now. It's 10 years this summer, and I didn't go to Liverpool yet, believe it or not, because I just thought, well, it's going to happen, you know. It's going to happen before I leave England. I will get up there and see it, you know. And so I never, ever thought that it was going to be when I was going to shoot a video for Time Won't Wait, which I'm going to record with John's producer. I never, you know, completely unplanned. And so to go up there for the first time to do that was a thrill, and consequently, I love Liverpool. I'm in love with the place. I actually would love to live up there. It's really nice up there. I think that it's better than London these days because London is very, there's not much of a music scene going on anywhere in England anymore, but London, there's really nothing going on, and it's not a music town anymore. It's not an art town anymore. Those things exist, but it's not the predominant feeling of the city as it was always. Up until the year 2000, the predominant city feeling around London was always arts, especially music. But that's gone. It's been replaced with building developments by very, very wealthy Saudi Arabians. And that's what's going on in London now. And it's just, who wants that, you know? So, but Liverpool is another story. Liverpool just still feels like an old-fashioned English city. And it's got its nice section, and it's got its sections that are a bit more urban. And, it's really a great place. And there's a complete Beatle feeling up there. It's magical. It's amazing that you can feel it. It permeates the air.
We're taking another pause to listen to A Song for New York by Roxanne Fontana.
Thank you. she's going to run.
This is NYPC Radio, the New York Podcasting Cafe, with host, Carmen Amoros.
The magic of it all is that not only were you in Liverpool, which is where the boys, the Beatles, were from, but you also have the opportunity to record with Douglas, Lennon's producer, on this particular song. This is just surreal.
Well, I wasn't going to get too carried away with the fact that it was unbelievable because I had work to do and I had to make sure that everything was done properly. And it's funny because I'm the kind of person, as much as I'm a music fanatic, I'm never really too much in awe of any stars. I'm too vain or something, but I'm not that kind of a person unless it was a Beatle. And so Jack is not a Beatle, but it's pretty darn close. So I had to really, you know, keep my wits about me, because, you know, and plus nobody is infallible. Even Jack Douglas or the Beatles could possibly do something wrong. And I'm a perfectionist with my music. And here I am doing a song that's so dear to my heart. I had to make sure that I was going to love it. And so when we were recording the song, we, you know, on day two, when we were done with the vocals and doing the mix, I had to really be critical to make sure that I love this. And, you know, originally we had talked about doing it like a girl group sound, and this was pretty much my idea, and he was gung-ho with that idea, like, we're going to do this, we're going to do backup vocals. And then we did it, and I didn't like it. And I said, you know, this just, these, you know, this isn't working. What I'm hearing here that's magical is my vocal sounds so sad, and we need to take that and bring it out and forget this girl group sound and get rid of these backup vocals of the other girls, and let's just take this sad girl singing the song. And so this wasn't what we planned, but you see, if I was completely in awe of Jack, it would have ended up what he thinks that I wanted, and I probably wouldn't have liked it as much. So I couldn't, as much as I realized this is a dream come true, I had to be really on my toes to make sure we're going to make the record that's going to be something that I'm going to love, because I'm going to be living with this now for the rest of my life, you know. And so, yeah, I was in awe, but I was also very much into, okay, I'm working. You know, the dream is here, it's arrived, make sure it comes out good. And so when we were done with the song and I came back, then it really was a time, when I came back from New York, that was really a time to go, wow, I can't believe that just happened. I can't believe that I actually did this song in a decent studio with John's producer, and this is what it sounds like. Then it was really time to sort of, like, you know, flip and say, wow, I can't believe that happened, you know. But at the time, I was very sober in you know, making sure it got done right.
It's certainly a tribute to John Lennon also. It's such a beautiful tribute to him, really beautiful piece.
It is. Well, it's, you know, it's almost embarrassing because the lyrics are so prophetic. I mean, it was just a song that I wrote, and it wasn't about anybody, and yet it talks about, you know, I looked out every window to find the sun. It seems that something's wrong, some damage done. And what is that about? I don't know what that's about, you know. But there it was. It was about to happen 3 hours later, you know. And then the whole, it's about a girl talking about, you know, losing the opportunity to meet a guy. You know, she's pining for someone she never met, which is completely unusual. And I didn't know what it was about. It's just that the lines sounded good together. You know, when you write songs, you put the words together, and that's and so you're building like a story. So it's not always about somebody in particular. You're just building like, well, that line sounds good after that. And then what ended up happening was it ended up sounding as if I might have wrote it after he died, but I didn't. You know, I wrote it a few hours before. So that blows my mind. You know,
I believe you. The authenticity and the tone with which you're talking about it certainly comes out. I really do believe that you wrote the song.
Yeah, you know, you have to believe in the magic of the moment, especially when it pertains to art. And this was the thing, was, you know, when I announced that I was going to do the song, at first I was looking for an executive producer for it, and I put it on social media. And I think even when it came out, I published on the social media my copyright form, because I thought, you know, so many people are just full of it, you know, and they're going to think that I'm making this up, you know, for publicity. But let's face it, it is a gimmick, you know. As an indie artist, you know, you've got these songs out. Now this one's got a gimmick attached to it, and that's completely true. But the thing is that it was honest. It really did happen that way. And, you know, so I put out the copyright form to show that when I copywrote it, they ask you what year it was completed and the month. I put the month even, because even when I copywrote it years later, I wrote 1980 and December. They never even ask you for that month. But I've always been blown away that I wrote this song that night, you know. And so, it's a special gift, you know. It was like a gift given to me on a night when the world was delivered a horror. And the horror was for me as well, because I was such a Beatles fanatic. And that was really the death of John Lennon. The reason why it was really bad was you knew that there was never going to be any Beatles anymore. That was it, you know, because when it happened, the first thing I thought was, oh, well, this is crazy. You know, he was making a comeback and the album is just out. And then the next day after he died, when it was, you know, it reminded all of us that it was about the Beatles, and that's when it really, you know, that's what made it really hit so hard, you know?
Yes, it did. And the song that you wrote is actually written in the voice of people that love John Lennon. That's how I see it. And you're not just a girl singing it in your sad voice. It's almost the voices and the interpretation of the people that really loved him. and came to meet him, even for a moment, or even when they didn't meet him. You know, he was a lovable Beatle. He was a lovable guy. Very, very funny,
yes.
Very earthy, very, you know, real, very authentic.
Yes, so I think you could be right about the way... I think you're right about the way that you feel about it, because it's been so well received by Beatle fans and John Lennon fans. I've been on Beatle shows with this song. You know, I've been on
yes.
many radio shows
yes.
of Beatle fans. And when I went up to Liverpool to shoot, because I was doing mm-hmm. it, I actually did it on the weekend. And
mm-hmm.
and every 20 minutes, there were loads of, you know, tour groups being dropped off where I was shooting. And
mm-hmm.
they were all like, what are you doing? Who are you and what are you doing? And so I had to tell them, well, you know, I just recorded this song and I'm doing a video. And everybody was so nice. And people were passing by and they were putting their mobile phones over the music so they could hear it. And the reception I got was so amazing. And it wasn't at all cynical. It was really welcoming. And they were loving what they heard and they were liking the way I looked. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it's been like that since I've shot the video, that I've had this real... great affection from Beatle fans, which is great,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Including myself, because let me tell you, the song, the words that, as you wrote them, are pretty much my story. You know, I bumped into him. I didn't recognize him. He was trying very hard to
mm-hmm.
be recognized, and my dumbass mind didn't click, didn't register. And here I am reading your beautiful lyrics. I've looked out every window to find the sun. It seems that something's wrong now. And I know that was your moment where you had the premonition that something wasn't right. But then when you say, you go on and you say, I walked down every street where he used to go. And when I worked in Manhattan,
mm-hmm.
I was practically everywhere that he went. So the lyrics made me think about, gee, you know, that's true. I could have said something, and I didn't. The moment came and went, and, you know, it was too early, but then now it's
yeah.
mostly too late. And I'm like, this is just, I'm sure this is something that happened to a lot of people also out there.
Yes.
They saw him, they spoke to him, or they didn't, and then they missed that moment. And your song really hits the heart of it.
Thank you.
Beautiful song.
Thank you.
You know, not only did you write this marvelous song, but you've got... five singles, you've got two CDs and five films in your pocket. Also, you were also an actress.
Oh yes, I did a bunch of things in the 70s, just a bunch of film shorts with somebody who's a bit of a cult hero that's from Long Island. Yeah, I did those. Those were fun. But yeah, I'm into that, you know, because I mean, in a lot of ways as an artist, I feel like a bit of an actress, because I'm the kind of artist that can revel in the drama of the moment.
It's clear to see it, even subconsciously. Even while you were on December the 8th, you didn't know what was to come. Somehow, in extraordinary way or supernatural way, sensed something that was happening, and you wrote this song, this beautiful song. And it has a very, not just haunting, but it has a spiritual quality to it that I like.
Thank you very much.
Volumes.
Yes, thank
that
you.
That speaks volumes about the work that you do. And I think, I hate to keep bringing up New York and Brooklyn, but I think the fact that, you know, you're originally from here, there's something that you bring to the art because of...
That's right. I completely agree with you. That's true.
Now, can people download this song? You said you released
it. Oh, yes. I'm so sorry you asked me that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. So it's available on iTunes. Time Won't Wait is available on iTunes. All my music is on the stuff that's been released, the records, the singles. They're all on iTunes. They're also on CD Baby, which is a very popular American
mm-hmm.
distributor.
Yes.
And they're also out of England on another site called Music Glue, which
mm-hmm.
has a lot of my music on it, and I think they have posters and things like that. And so, and then there's my book. My book is available through Amazon, and
mm-hmm.
It's on Kindle, it's or downloading it to your own computer. I'm not really sure, because I'm selling my book that way, but I'm not that kind of a person. So when I put it into print, it's going to be just as much for me as it's going to be for you who are waiting for it to be in print and don't want to read it on a Kindle or on the computer. So it
mm-hmm.
will come out this year as a book, as a hardcover, hard copy book. And but for now, if people want to read it, it's available for download on Amazon. Yes.
Great, great, great.
And
now,
the reviews of American Girl that are on Amazon are pretty good with explaining what the book is like. So if anybody wants to get the book but they're not sure if they're going to enjoy it, if you read all those reviews on Amazon that people have put on, then you'll get an idea if it's something that you might like.
You bring so much to the table as an artist.
I think that's fabulous. I like that about people who are creative and they don't let the grass grow under their feet. You know, you just really get out there and you get things done.
Yes, yes, Carmen, that's true. And I'm glad that you appreciate it. You know, I think the reason why people are interested in me now is because I have been sort of busy doing all these things and my viewpoints on things are interesting and they're refreshing and I'm not so cookie cutter. And that's refreshing to me that people are interested in that because I can get cynical thinking, oh, well, you know, people are just into, you know, people who only do this or that and what they're told to like. And so for people to be interested in what I'm doing because it's interesting, you know what I mean,
mm-hmm.
then that makes me feel good about the world. So it works both ways. That's good.
So
thank you. Well, you know, it's not without effort. It's not without effort. I try to be healthy. I don't drink much. I don't, you know, do any drugs. I'm really clean living. I only eat pretty much organic foods. I don't really eat meat more than a few times a year. And I try to exercise and try to do all of these things and you know, just try to sort of maintain my, I think a lot of it has to do with the same thing that goes along with writing music and designing clothes. It's so, and, mm-hmm. and to do that, you have to be healthy. So I'm really trying. But mm-hmm. to be fair, I've always looked younger than my age. I remember at one point I was living with my parents and a friend of my father's came over and he said to me, my father told me afterwards that his friend said, she's 25 years old. She looks like she's 12. So I've always had this look like I was younger than my age. So now it's really coming in handy. So I guess that's pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, if I keep my health together, maybe I'll stick around long enough to write myself into the history books, right?
So. Yes, you certainly will. I think you've already done that. Thank you for being on here with me today. Before I wrap up, I just wanted, again, for you to repeat where the people can find you. You said iTunes and Amazon, right, your music?
Yes, the music that I've put out is available on iTunes. Time Won't Wait mm-hmm. is available on iTunes, and mm-hmm. also CD Baby, which is an American distributor of independent mm-hmm. music. And in the right. UK, Music Glue, but Music Glue also does international. And the book is on Amazon. And I'm not on any of the streaming systems, which I'm boycotting until they pay realistic rates. Until then, mm-hmm. if people want to hear it, they can either watch it on YouTube, which is I don't mind because they're appreciating the visual as well, or mm-hmm. they can purchase it on iTunes or CD Baby or Music Glue, or directly. No, actually, I'm not doing anything direct, so it would be through those companies.
Okay, got it.
Roxanne Fontana will bring up probably all of the videos that I put on there, the ones from the early days and the ones that mm-hmm. we ended up doing in South of France to the Souvenir du Mont record. Roxanne mm-hmm. Fontana is on Facebook.
I love your music. Can you
yes,
introduce
well, this,
the song
this, how, yes, sure. Okay. Carmen is about to play Time Won't Wait.
Thank you, Roxanne Fontana, for being on my program. It's been an honor.
Thank you too, Carmen. Okay, Brooklyn
Rock.
I love it.
I hope you come back. Okay, thank
okay,
you, ladies
bye-bye.
And gentlemen. Here is singing Time Won't Wait, Roxanne Fontana.
Thank you.
listening to an interview with singer, songwriter, fashion designer, and artiste Roxanne Fontana. To reach her, go to Facebook and do a search of her name, Roxanne, R-O-X-A-N-N-E, Fontana, F-O-N-T-A-N-A. You can also find her music on iTunes. Thank you for joining Carmen Amoros on NYPC Radio, the New York Podcasting Cafe. Please search us on Facebook and like our page. I'll see you real soon.
This is NYPC Radio, the New York Podcasting Cafe, with host Carmen Amoros.